This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On ABC Listen.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Well, if you looked up beleaguered in the dictionary in 2026, you'd probably see Michael Voss, the grim, determined face of Michael Voss. He's now out of his misery. But are you as Carlton fans? Just before round 10, he's gone, he's resigned. Is that too soon? Is that about right? Is it too late? But is it too soon? What next for players having an interim coach for 15 weeks? Tell me what you think. We'll keep the conversation going because, let's face it, it's been a conversation for all of those 10 weeks. What do you think? Weigh in now. What's next for Carlton? What next also for those players? Max Gawn, the D's captain, said, look, it was hard enough dragging his players through 3 weeks of an interim coach. What do you do with 15? He was pretty rough on the decision. What do you think? Is it unfair on the players? Or is it fair enough because you have to get some of the controversy out of your system? Tell me what you think. Also today, are we changing our relationships with broken promises in politics? It's not a surprise now that the federal government in the budget tonight will dump an election promise, that is, not to touch negative gearing. And once upon a time, it seemed like a real moral question, that the promises of a politician, particularly in an election campaign, are like political marriage vows. The cost of breaking them is moral to us. It's not just transactional. Tell me what you think. Do you care about broken promises more than the merits of policy changes? Have things changed for you? Have we changed? Things are different now in many ways. News cycles are shorter, concentration spans are shorter, times, arguably, very arguably, are tougher. Does a leader keeping promises still matter to you? What's the sort of leadership that you want these days? Is it consistency or is it responsiveness? We're going to be speaking to someone who was in the room making a calculus of whether to break a promise in the Julia Gillard government. That was around the carbon tax. What was the calculus then? We'll ask Sean Kelly. And what is it now? And we'll also talk to someone who is involved in studies that look at whether the government keeping promises in reality, how many times they actually do keep their promises, is at odds with our perception of whether they do. And the results might surprise you, what it is that we look at and look for and remember. We're going to also just see how hard it is for politicians to gain and keep trust these days. What gains your trust, particularly when it comes from politics? Let me know your thoughts on government's broken promises. But at 11 past, at 8 past 11, the freshly broken coaching career of Michael Voss.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Here to help us reflect on the coaching career and legacy of Michael Voss, Associate Professor Matthew Klugman, Institute for Health and Sport at Victoria University. Thanks for joining me, Matthew.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
How would you sum up Michael Voss's coaching legacy, as it were, this year?
Look, he's had a couple of goes, and there were definite highs. You know, his first year, with the Lions, he took them to a final, and then he broke the 10-year drought with the Carlton men and took them to a prelim. But I think disappointing overall, and it's kind of the end of an era because you had Voss, you had Hurd, and you had Buckley, as well as Goods, as these kind of four dominant men for a long time. And then three of them, you know, one was booed out of the game. And then the other three all went into coaching as these decorated players and all of them failed.
Well, it adds into the annals of history, the star players who become coaches. What's your reflection on the strike rate there?
Yeah, look, it's not that high. Obviously, you know, you've got people like Ron Barassi, who is extraordinary. But yeah, a lot more misses than hits. I mean, coaching such a stressful position, you know. Unlike the players, they're not loved by the fans in the same way unless they really deliver. And, you know, you've got 18 coaches of the men's competition and all of them are there with this directive, you know, where, you know, to be successful, they have to win a flag.
How do we stand in terms of the blood lust that we have when it comes to coaches? Are we letting them... In particular, Voss's case, are we letting them have too long or is it about right? Is it about what it's always been?
Yeah, it's one of those eternal questions. You know, he had, you know, quite early that success. You know, you can understand Carlton keeping him on. But, yeah, the fans were starting to really, you know, voice their disapproval very intensely, and that kind of lame duck position this year didn't help anyone. I knew a Carlton fan who used to position herself just near the players' race just so she could shout abuse at whichever Carlton coach there was during that time. So it's always been very intense.
Exactly. That makes it sound as if Michael Voss's future will at least have a little bit of relief in the short term.
Yeah, for sure. I think a lot of coaches, like, you know, obviously there's the devastation of not having done what you wished, but I think there's immense relief from getting out of that kind of awful cold room.
Indeed. It might be the first deep breath he's been able to take for 10 rounds. Matthew Cookman, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, cheers.
Matthew Cookman is an associate professor at Victoria University. We are talking about Carlton, we are talking about broken promises, broken coaching careers, and also what this means for the players. As I mentioned this morning, Max Gawn, Melbourne D's captain, of course, who had to take his players as captain through 3 weeks of an interim coach, said, wow, that was hard enough. He didn't think he could make it to a fourth, let alone 15 weeks that the Carlton players have to. But this on text... On Voss, 18 players are out there on the field. If they can't play to win, they should get out. Have you got any more sympathy for the Carlton players? What do you believe should be their attitude going forward? 1300 222 774 is the number to call to join either of these conversations. We're talking Carlton. We're also talking broken promises. And we are talking about the budget, because that is what we're all looking at when it comes to these broken promises. But let's zoom out a little more broadly and think about the most vulnerable people in our society. What do they most want from the budget?
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is the Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
It's 13 minutes past 11. Joining me now is Dr. Cassandra Goldie, CEO of ACOS, that of course represents some of the more vulnerable people in our society. Thanks for joining us, Cassandra.
Yes, good morning.
What do you most want to see? What do you most want promised, as it were, from this budget?
Well, we certainly want the budget to give top priority to protecting people who are most at risk of the ongoing increases in the cost of essentials and, of course, the latest economic shock with the global events, and also to do the big reforms that we do need to set the country up for now and into the future. There's no question the housing crisis, big debate, as you know, and we're very hopeful that we will see movement on those property investor tax breaks and also some scaling back of the arrangements around trusts, because there's no question out there in Australia there's a great sense of growing unfairness, of some people being really excluded from being able to meet their essential needs like housing, like food, and paying their energy bills, and yet they can see that others are doing very well. And so I think this is a time to bring the country together and say we are prepared to take the hard decisions to set the country up better, but we've got to make sure that we're protecting people on the lowest incomes first. And we're very worried that we're not going to see that in this budget. Of course, we'll wait to see tonight what happens.
Of course, as you refer to there, the negative gearing, the trust changes, they've got a lot of focus on them tonight. What's your estimate of how long, first off, from what you've heard already, what has been extensively leaked, do you support these reforms that we're hearing about? And how long will it actually take to flow through to the people that you're looking at who are really in need of particularly housing relief?
Well, look, we've urged the government to move on both scaling back the very generous capital gains tax discount from 50% down to 25% over the next 5 years, and to scale back the negative gearing for properties immediately, for new investments, and for those that are already in the housing market to scale that back over the next 5 years. Now, look, I appreciate we might get a different design tonight, and of course, we'll wait to see the detail of that. But I think we've got to give confidence to the community that the government is prepared to move on what we've always said. ACOS has always raised this issue. We know that the housing tax arrangements have been very damaging for housing affordability. We've seen a great acceleration in wealth inequality in Australia over the last 30 years. The wealth of people in the top 20% has increased at four times the rate of people in the bottom 20%. And this is why our social fabric is feeling so fragile right now, because far too many people are feeling excluded from the wealth that is being gained in this country. So, I mean, trust is another area. Of course, we do want to see people paying their fair share of tax, and there's about a million trust structures out there which are often used just to minimise your taxable income, and yet others who are fully exposed in terms of the tax system, income tax system, of course, are paying their fair share in our progressive income tax system. I mean, I do want to highlight today that there are about 4 million people who are on incomes so low that they don't even get exposed to paying income tax. In other words, they're below the tax-free threshold. They are the hardest hit by the cost of living crisis. People on JobSeeker, $500 per week. Imagine that. Yeah. And on average, they've got less than $500 behind them. And so we really hope we're going to see in this budget some help for them. And not
what sort
just
of help for
the
them?
Tax system. Well, we certainly want to see an increase to the base rates of JobSeeker and Youth Allowance. We need targeted help to people. At the moment, of course, everybody's talking about inflation. And unfortunately, as we see interest rates go up, which we were, you know, very disappointed to see, we're predicting we're going to see a further rise in unemployment. By the end of the year, we could see, depending on what happens, up to 400,000 more people fall out of paid work because of what's happening in the economy. So we have to lift that safety net. I'm a member of the government's Economic Inclusion Advisory Committee that for the last 4 years has provided advice to government about what it should do in the budget. Its top recommendation, again, is to lift the adequacy of our social security payments, particularly for those on the lowest, which are people on JobSeeker and Youth Allowance.
You say again, how many years have you been asking for that?
This is the fourth year this report has made this as the top recommendation. We've seen one increase of $20 per week a couple of years ago. It was a step, but nowhere near what was needed. And as we've delivered successively income tax cuts, let's not forget those stage three income tax cuts. They were very big.
Yes, that was another promise.
They were very big for people who benefited from them. And again, people who were outside of the income tax system, but paying, you know, the price of increases in costs of essentials like food and housing, who are relying on our important income support system for a range of reasons. If you're a single parent, if you're a person with a disability, if you're a person on the age pension who doesn't have much behind you, you are fully exposed. And we really want to see in tonight's budget what the government will do to help them.
Dr. Cassandra Goldie, will touch base and see what you think after the budget. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That's Dr. Cassandra Goldie, CEO of ACOS. We're talking about the budget. We're talking about broken promises, how much it means these days politically, in our democracy, in our media environment. Do we even notice this on text? I'd much rather hear analysis of whether the tax changes are good policy rather than spend the entire day navel-gazing about whether a pinky promise was broken. Is that how you feel about it as well? What sort of leadership do you want? Where should the priority be? Is it on promises or not? Have we moved on from that, or are we needing that more than ever? Join the conversation. Coming up next, we're going to talk to someone who is in a room that decided to break a promise. We'll see what was the calculation behind that.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
All the talk is about collapsing trust, that politicians aren't judged by what they say. but whether voters believe they'll actually deliver. So what does it mean these days in politics and beyond to not actually deliver on a promise? Sean Kelly is an author, a regular columnist in the papers, a former advisor also to Julia Gillard and Kevin Rudd, and joins me now. How are you going, Sean?
I'm very much looking forward to seeing what's in the budget.
Yes, I'm sure. Let's go back. As I promoed you, you were in a room when one of the most, and there have been dozens and dozens from all sides of politics, promises that have been broken. And this was the Julia Gillard carbon tax promise. What's your reflection now on the calculus around that? How important it was at the time to not do that, and why then you did it? What you felt was, I guess, the point of compromise there?
Well, I think the major reason that it was important was that it was the right policy. And I think we've seen that in the fact that it worked. Emissions came down. It worked very efficiently. And the fact that we just haven't had a climate policy as good as that, as strong as that since. And that's been very destructive for Australia's climate action and also for the economy. So that's number one reason. But then number two is, of course, Julia Gillard was having to govern with independents, with the Greens. And so there was this clear sense that part of the reason that and, you know, and other changes were made to the election platform was a result of those negotiations. And I think that really, really harmed her.
Mm. So this notion, though, of keeping promises essentially for the sake of them, then, is this a reasonable discussion in your view, or has it ever been thus in politics that, you know, when someone either believes or it's convenient to break a promise, it just happens?
Yeah, look, it's a little bit of both. I don't think we should skip entirely past the notion of integrity, the idea that politicians tell us in an election what they're going to do, and then we get to hold to account for that. Mm. But on the other hand, I do think that trust works in mysterious ways in politics. It is true that there is a question about whether you trust exactly what a politician says during an election campaign. But then there is, I think, a broader question. It's whether you trust them to act consistently with their own character, whether you trust them to act consistently with their own beliefs. And I think a problem over the last decade or so, as the debate has become more polarised, as the media has become quite ferocious, and social media has become quite ferocious, is that politicians have become terrified of scare campaigns. They rule things out. They rule things out that are in accordance with their beliefs. And so we're kind of voting for politicians because we think they won't change things. But we also know they're kind of betraying themselves. And then they get up there, they become the Prime Minister, and we punish them a bit for not actually following their heart. And I think, and I think this is an important complication in the way we think of trust. Do we trust a politician to do the right thing by the country? And that is a slightly, well, often a very, very large difference between that and actually following through on the letter of the law of what you said at an election.
That's so fascinating. Sean Kelly, you're listening to a former Gillard Rudd advisor, now turned commentator. We're talking about broken promises and what it really means in politics these days. Interesting point you bring up there, Sean, because it's really an intersection then, not about ideology versus being transactional, but this idea certainly that One Nation has, and the Nationals also have picked up on authenticity as well. I know Jim Chalmers this morning is saying in part that this budget will be a little bit about countering that rise of One Nation as well.
Well, exactly. I mean, we had this shockingly decisive win in Farah for One Nation. I think Labor is clearly worried, as it should be, about One Nation gaining momentum because of the history of its racist policies. I think that is a very worrying thing for the nation. And so they're wondering, well, what else is driving One Nation support? And part of it is a sense that the system simply isn't working for people. Mm. One of the ways that broken promises sometimes work is that people won't punish a government if they feel the broken promise is in their favour. So this happened in the first term of this government when Anthony Albanese broke his promise on the Stage 3 tax cuts. Very clear broken promise. But people overwhelmingly benefited from that change. Even the people who had less of a tax cut than they thought they were going to get at the top end of the income, still got a pretty hefty tax cut in the end, so nobody suffered that much. And people accepted that very quickly. And I think here, while the maths is a little bit different about exactly who wins and loses, because of this broad sense that people are losing out, that people are being done over by the system, I think when you act to change the way that the economy discriminates against people, discriminates against people who only rely on an income to live rather than assets, I think people overwhelmingly may well have a sense that they are benefiting from it. And that is a really important adjustment, I think, to One Nation's appeal.
You're listening to Sean Kelly, turned commentator now, but former Gillard Rudd advisor. So he's been there when the decisions have been made. Jay, you've called in from Hyatt. What do you think about broken promises?
Yes, I did.
What do you think, Jay, about broken promises?
I don't know. I have a thing that why don't politicians, when they say make these promises, use the old Latin term ceteris paribus, all things remaining the same. We live in a changing world. Things change from day to day, both internationally and nationally. Of course, policy may have to change based on the conditions. I mean, how can you hold politicians responsible if everything is changing in front of them and they do nothing, saying, oh, no, but I promised, this is what I promised.
Yeah, responsiveness means more to you, Jay.
Yes.
Yep. Jay,
it's got to change with the times.
Thank you, Jay, for calling in. And Pat, you've called in from Macrae. I don't think you agree. Is that right?
I think it's Sean. Is it Sean Kelly?
That's right.
You're there?
Yes.
Yeah, I think Sean's been in politics a long time because I hear weasel words. Because I hear somebody saying that, you know, it's okay to break a promise, but we vote for our politicians based on making those promises and their integrity to keep them and to sell them to us through communicating effectively what they're trying to achieve.
So you believe that the promises are the sign of integrity. Thank you, Pat. I guess, Sean, this is what the federal government is up against. And one other lens also to put on this is, I know you've written about this quite a bit, that this is an ambitious, or well, that's how they've described it themselves, but we've been waiting for a bit of ambition from this federal government. Do you think this ambition is overdue?
Look, I absolutely think this ambition is overdue. And I think Pat's right, by the way. I think that politicians should tell us what they're going to do in an election. And if they say they're not going to do something, they should stick to that. But I think the truth is, most of the time, they have a fair sense in advance of what promises they may well break down the track. And so the point for me is not that they shouldn't act differently. It's that they should refrain from making those promises at election time. I think there really is something to that. Now, I think the caution that they've shown over the last 4 years could be a really interesting factor in this, in these particular measures on cutting into property tax discounts, property tax breaks. Mm. Firstly, because it makes this decision very bold in comparison. I think that will really, give them a tick on the ambition front. But secondly, I think it weakens their ability to argue for it. And that is simply because they don't have a lot of experience arguing for big changes. They don't have a lot of experience defending changes which are going to affect large numbers of people. And tax debates in particular are very difficult. Politicians often make mistakes on the details. So I think that is going to complicate their ability to make to overcome the penalty of the broken promise as well.
And in what has been leaked so far, do you believe that that mixture of ambition and, I guess, comfort level in a changing world has been reached by this the guardrails around the changes to negative gearing, for instance?
It's very hard to tell. I think on balance, my answer would be yes. There is a little bit of a sense that on the capital gains tax discount changes, that will apply to all asset classes, not property. And I think a concern for me about the government's ability to prosecute this is that they might just have taken on one front too many rather than restricting this to a debate about property, because I think there is a huge appetite in the electorate for change on housing, a huge awareness of the inequities, both generational and within generations, when it comes to people's ability to own houses and to reap the investor benefits of houses. But they have, as you say, they've put guardrails around this. There'll be a bit of delay in the way that these are put in place. And so I think they probably will satisfy a large number of people. There will still be a ferocious campaign. There will still be a ferocious campaign on the broken promises. There's a lot of footage out there of Anthony Albanese saying he's not going to do this. And so, you know, the government has its arguments ready to run. I haven't been that convinced by them in the past 24 hours when they say things like, when they try to explain what has changed in the last year, because the truth is not that much has changed.
Despite the ceteris paribus argument. But I guess...
Well, exactly.
And the corollary to that is, sure, how well will their selling of that run, but also how well will the opposition really be able to pin this on the government, given the opposition's woes at the moment as well?
Well, it's not only the opposition's woes. The opposition have their own history of, well, not quite broken promises, but certainly inconsistency or hypocrisy on this. You've had, you know, senior members of the Liberal Party, like Tim Wilson, the Shadow Treasurer, Dave Sharma, saying things that are very much in line with what Labor seems about to do. So it'll be quite difficult for them to make the opposite case. And you can absolutely expect in question time, Jim Chalmers and Anthony Albanese to be throwing the Liberals' past quotes back in their faces.
Inevitably, really, Sean. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Sean Kelly is former Gillard and Rudd advisor, termed commentator and author, and is in the Nine newspapers as well. Michael in Foster says, I think we ought to respect honourable agility or adaptability, but self-interest is an abiding compass for voters. It's a tough equation for governments. What do you think? Alex, you've called from Traralgon. What did you want to say?
I think, you know, we vote in politicians based on what they are promising and what's in the best interest for ourselves when we do that. And for them to backflip on their promises sort of goes against why we vote them in the first place.
So it would determine your vote, Alex?
Absolutely. You know, we're all in a space where we're trying to minimise our taxes and make as much money as we can so we can survive comfortably. And when the politicians change their minds on those things, it really affects us day to day.
You're right, Alex, that it's essentially, you know, this debate, particularly around housing and negative gearing in particular, has gone on for so long. And I'm gleaning what you think about that. Does it matter if it's not, if it's another decision that you do agree with? Does it matter if it's not as high profile a broken promise?
I think so. I think, you know, we judge our politicians based on their truths and what they're preaching to us.
And that's most important for you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, there's a lot of talk at the moment about taxing big gas and oil industries. I know Sean said before that politicians are there to do what's the best for us, and, you know, they're taxing the everyday Australian more while they keep avoiding the other end of the spectrum.
The tax on the gas.
Yeah.
Alex, thank you for calling in. Really appreciate hearing your point. Louise from Doncaster says, the only people making a fuss about broken promises are journalists. If something needs to be done, it needs to be done now, not in 3 years after the next election. Yes, do you agree with Louise? Do you agree with Alex? I'd love to hear from you. But also, how hard is it for politicians to even establish trust these days in the media environment that we have with all that social media noise that Sean was talking about as well? Do we believe anything we hear anymore? Joining me now is Professor Andrea Carson, who's just been appointed new director of the University of Melbourne Centre for Advancing Journalism. Hi, Andrea.
Hi, Mary.
You've been looking specifically at the reality around broken promises versus our perceptions. Sounds fascinating to me. What did you find?
So this was a little while ago, and it complements research that's been going on around the globe as to whether political parties keep promises. And we were working off the back of some major work that had been done in Europe and the US, and we looked at the minority government of the Gillard era between 2010 and 2013 to see whether the Gillard government kept promises. And what we found was that, in essence, they did, but it may be not how the public remembers it, because a very big promise was perceived to have been broken around carbon tax. And so we know that not all promises are equal. So, for example, under the Gillard era, they passed over 500 pieces of legislation, many decisions being made every day. But, of course, the public doesn't usually get to see up close all of those decisions. We just remember the big ones.
The big ones, or the most important to us, or both?
Yeah, I think we talk about salience, which is what's most important to the public. There's also media salience, and I think one of your callers touched on this about what the media thinks is important, and that doesn't always align with what the public thinks are important, but quite often they do.
Yeah, they do. Ian, you called in from Surry Hills. What did you want to say?
Yes, look, I was just looking at the broken promise situation. If you take an analogy, if you're going on a fishing trip and then you get a storm, you don't go out, do you? You change your mind. Mm. Now, I think if they said before the elections, look, this is what we reckon we're going to do, but if things change dramatically, we're going to have to review things along the track. But this is what we think at the moment. Now, if you like what we're thinking, then vote for us. If you don't, then don't.
And that's about communication, isn't it, Ian? It depends on how good the communication is, how well the reasons are given, I guess.
That's right. Well, if you take the other situation where pensioners are not allowed to work, they get penalised. Now, if they came out with a policy there and said, righto, guys, if you're 65 to 85 or something and you want to do a few hours extra a week, okay, you can do that and you pay tax on it. But we don't penalise you and take away your pension to do it. You're going to pay tax anyway. So if that was a policy, people would look at it. Mm. And there are other policies as well that come into this equation, I think. And I think any government is bound to any business is bound to review a policy, even a company.
Yeah, especially
if it doesn't work, you know.
Especially in changing times. Ian, thank you. Great to hear from you. Cola, you've called in from Horsham. What did you want to say?
Good morning, Mary. Look, this word promise, it's just a gush of hot wind. They never promised us anything. It was part of their platform and their proposals to get themselves elected. They never said, oh, we promise we'll do this, we'll promise we'll do that.
Anthony Albanese was asked whether he'd touch negative gearing and he said, nope, not at all.
He was asked, but yes. He never promised he wouldn't.
Ah, that's the difference for you, Cola?
Of course it is. I mean, look, if you make an agreement with someone, that's an agreement. It's not a promise. And it was part of their political platform to do this and not to do that.
Cola, thank you. Lovely to hear from you. Do you agree with Cola? 1300 222 774. Professor Andrea Carson is still with me. She is from the University of Melbourne's Centre for Advancing Journalism. Those two calls really do highlight the tension there, doesn't it, Andrea, in terms of trust in government, what we base it on. What's the overall situation, the overall level of trust about what we hear in the news from politicians?
So this is something a group of scholars, including myself, are researching at the moment, and we find there's two forms of trust. There's direct trust in politicians and then trust in the system, in democracy more broadly. And we find there's different levels of trust that people tend in Australia to be fairly trusting that the democratic system's working, although that has lost a bit of bark recently. But trust in individual politicians varies quite dramatically across the spectrum. And it depends on three qualities, which are usually integrity, benevolence, and whether they've kept their promises in the past, competence, how well they do their job. And how much someone weighs in a broken promise depends on which of those measures they most use when they're evaluating how much they trust a politician. And it won't surprise you, Mary, that it varies depending on whether they're a supporter of that party or not.
Yes, that's, of course, the through line for a lot of people. But also interesting to hear different sort of approaches from the people we are hearing on our line, 1300 222 774. Wes, you've called from Eaglemont. What did you want to say?
Yeah, I think Albanese made a huge mistake when he made that promise. He could have just said, well, look, on that issue, we're aware that people have conflicting views and we're going to listen to the public. We'll take notice of the polls on the issue and we'll make the appropriate decision. If he had said that, he wouldn't be in such a pickle.
So don't make hard and fast promises, Wes.
Well, not on an issue like that, which is obviously at the time he made that promise, there was a fair bit of conflict and he was making it for political reasons because he was under pressure from the coalition at the time.
Wes,
you know, but I mean, I'm a property investor and I support these changes.
So that's that for you, that that justifies going past any wiggle room he might not have left himself?
It's in the national interest to do what he's doing, well, depending on the detail that comes out tonight. And therefore, I support the broken promise. Mm-hmm. I don't like broken promises, but when it's in the national interest, I think it's pretty clear it has to be done.
Wes, thank you. Thank you for calling in. Liz, you've called in from Rutherglen. What did you want to say?
Hi. Bill Shorten lost the apparently unlosable election because the polls prior suggested he would win in a landslide, but he lost because he took negative gearing changes to the election and the electorate didn't vote for that. So I feel that Albanese has been grossly dishonest, and I'm hugely disappointed because, you know, but Albanese is a smart politician. He understood it was political suicide, and he didn't commit the same sin that Bill did.
Oh, that's interesting, Liz. Basically, you feel like after Bill Shorten, they'd be pretty much not wanting to ever do it into an election.
Yeah.
Will that change your vote next time?
Well, the thing is about, I'm one of 10 children. I worked very, very, very hard to save money to buy land, which now is called an asset. And, you know, the changes to CGT, with my 3 children, I can't help them out if I was to pass away, because that land would need to be sold, because you can't split a piece of land 3 ways. And, you know, and so I really see CGT as a death tax by stealth.
Yeah.
Because it's penalising my children. But what really gets me is what incentivised me to work hard, to save, to buy property was, you know, the incentives. And I feel that if there's a housing shortage, why would you take away the incentives for private investment?
Thank you for calling in. Certainly, I can see that there's going to be a lot of people watching this budget with a lot of their own family implications in mind, like yours, Liz. Thank you. Professor Andrea Carson, those calls really do show the big risk that the government is taking on when it comes to this particular topic.
Yeah, they show us a number of things. The last caller just mentioned the 2019 election, so we know that this was a salient issue back then. But we also know that people vote for different reasons, and issues and broken promises might just be one of those reasons. Others vote because they are welded to a particular party, and some people still vote the way that they've traditionally always voted. They're rusted on to how their parents voted. So there's lots of different ways that we vote. But the other thing, I'm not sure whether this came up in your earlier conversation, is that the Albanese government it's 2026. They have 94 seats in the lower house. It's a massive majority. If they are going to take a risk, then some would argue now is the time for them to do that, and the opportunity loss if they don't do that. And as you touched on before, there's another 2 years to communicate these changes. As John Howard used to say, you can't fatten a pig on market day, and they've got time to communicate those changes between now and 2028. So it's very difficult to predict what the outcome might be with what is perceived to be a broken promise.
And indeed, in this binary situation, we know that the opposition will, you know, make its pitch, as Sean Kelly will hear, nothing but broken promises for the next few days. How well do you think that the opposition can use this as well?
Well, as Sean Kelly was saying that, I was already picturing the different ways they would be cutting up their ads for the 2028 election and all the social media memes that will go out and so forth. But, of course, we get a lot of political communication now, and not just from the opposition. It depends how effective they are with those messages, whether it becomes just noise or whether they're able to prosecute that argument. But I'm sure the operatives there will be watching very closely and thinking about how they can prosecute this argument of broken promises over the next 2 years and keep it effective.
Andrea, always fascinating to hear about your research. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary.
That's Professor Andrea Carson, who is the new director of the University of Melbourne Centre for Advancing Journalism at 16 minutes to 12. This from Peter in Thomastown. Most Australians can't handle the truth, unfortunately, to paraphrase Jack Nicholson. This on text. All of this is nothing more than poor attempts to justify and defend politicians being liars. But this from Merrill in Sunbury. Read the room. It's not about broken promises, but responding to current circumstances. If policy never adapts, then we go nowhere. I do want to return to your calls about what you want most from any leadership. Is it consistency or is it responsiveness? 1300 222 774 is the number to call about that. But let's also return to the other breaking news of this morning. Well, the biggest breaking news of this morning. Michael Voss out after round 10. What's his future? What's Carlton's future? And how do the players approach 15 rounds with an interim coach? That's coming up next.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Yes, it's The Conversation Hour, and the big conversation today has been around Carlton, Michael Voss. Even if you're not a footy fan, there's always something vaguely poignant about this when a team, a club is thrown into disarray and has to sort itself. And particularly when it comes to the players, it's round 10. There's 15 more rounds to go. An interim coach will be put in. Melbourne D's captain Max Gawn has been asked about this morning. He had a reflection based on last year when he had to captain his club through the last three rounds in an interim sense. He said he would have struggled to make a fourth. He said this decision today from Carlton is premature. A lot of people saying it was too late or about time. He says it's premature because of the players. So how do the players respond? I'm joined by Joel Bowden, former president of the AFL Players Association and best and fairest for Richmond as well. Thanks for joining me, Joel.
Oh, good morning, Mary.
First off, your reaction to the news this morning?
It was always coming, unfortunately, for Michael Voss and Carlton. Last year, they really didn't show what they needed to in the sense of Voss securing his long-term future there, and that was on the back of a couple of years where they'd played finals and won finals where they dropped last year. And I think, like many people, we probably expected last year for Voss to be given his marching orders, but Graham Wright, who came in as CEO and took over, put a steady hand to the ship and kept... That was probably a good decision in the end, because now they do get a CEO who had a fair bit of time in the chair to have a look at it and go after the next coach. And it seems to me that even if there's 15 rounds remaining in the season, this is a strategic decision so that Carlton can be the first team to go looking for a new coach. And there's a number of coaches out there at the moment in John Longmire and Ken Hinckley, Adam Simpson, who've all got experience. And I guess that also depends on whether they go for an experienced coach or they want to do what Collingwood did a few years ago when Nathan Buckley left Collingwood and they appoint a new coach in Craig McRae at the time.
While we're on that, what do you think they should do? Experience or new?
A new coach. Mm. I think they should go for a new coach. I was at Richmond and, well, I'll tell you what, we lost a few coaches in my time and we kept on going for experienced coaches, you know, and when Terry Wallace resigned or was sacked in 2009, the club and the board decided to go for a new coach. They went for Damien Hardwick. The rest is history. But I think the most important thing about that is you have to put really good people around them, that regardless of the person who is seen as the senior coach or the head coach, they need really good people, really good assistant coaches. And the biggest thing that the Richmond Football Club was, they got Neil Baum, and Neil Baum had the Midas touch. Everywhere he went, team won premiership. So I think Carlton need to find, you know, the best inexperienced coach, and maybe Daniel G and Siracusa, who is an old friend of mine and has been the assistant coach at a number of clubs in recent time, but put someone like Neil Baum around him, or bring in John Longmire or Ken Hinckley or Nathan Buckley to be that senior mentor, as well as half a dozen other assistant coaches who can develop that team, because it's professional. I mean, I know that Carlton footballers get to training most days at 8 a.m. in the morning.
Yeah,
it's a professional outfit, and I don't think there's going to be a huge impact on the players in the sense of they will still go, they'll just have a different voice and some slightly different tactics from the interim coach in Josh Fraser.
Joel Bowden, you're listening to former president of AFL Players Association and also former Richmond player. Your line was just breaking up there a little, Joel, but I feel we've got most of what you said. Just going back to the players there, as I said, I was a bit surprised about the strength of feeling behind Max Gawn's comments. He was basically saying, look, players are now sent off to the end of the year with their futures sort of having walked out the door. They're trying now to play for, to prove themselves in an unstable environment. You've said it's a professional decision in a professional league and a strategic one to get the best coach. What are the challenges ahead? You as a former player and drawing on your own experience there when coaches left, what do you think is going to be happening for the next 15 rounds?
Well, it could go one of two ways. And I know in my experience, when Danny Frawley resigned and coach off,
we seem to have a little bit of a bug with Joel's line. Should we try and call him back? I'm not quite sure. We'll try to do that. It's 10 minutes to 12. And we're just talking about Michael Voss. What do you think? Is this a roundabout time? Is it too early? Is it too late? 1300 222 774. Also here to join the conversation is Jake Nile, Chief AFL Writer for The Age. While we try to get Joel back, he's going to guide us through. Hi, Jake. What do you think about the timing of all this?
Oh, it's probably a couple of weeks early. I don't think anyone from early in the season thought Michael Voss would survive, certainly not into 2027. Mm-hmm. But there was a possibility that he would get well into the season. But look, they kept getting overrun in games, and in the end, that's been the end of him a little bit quicker. And obviously, he saw the writing on the wall. I think he had seen it for a while. So it's not really, as far as coach demises go, it's not a really surprising one.
It's not a surprising one, but as I was saying to Joel, a bit surprised by Max Gawn's strength of feeling about how hard it might be for Carlton for the rest of the season. What do you think's going to happen?
Well, it's not like it's been going that well.
That's right. Yeah.
So I don't think it's been a pattern of being very competitive against virtually every team they play. And finding a way to lose against Brisbane on the weekend, it was a bit of a reversal because they got well behind and came back strongly and had a puncher's chance of stealing the game, although I never thought they would. They played quite well, but of course, Voss's position was already decided by then.
So what's the way forward, Jake? There is this on text that the board should be sacked. There's going to be a lot of cries for other positions to be looked at. What do you think is going to happen? What's the word from behind the scenes?
Well, I would expect that Carlton will obviously they've got Josh Fraser filling in for the rest of the year as the caretaker. That's a good choice. They've been impressed by him so far this year. He's not going to be a candidate, you wouldn't think, for the senior coaching job in the future. And I think that they will most likely go for a process pretty similar to what Collingwood did in 2021 when Graham Wright, who was the head of football at Collingwood at the time, he's now the CEO at Carlton. And that was a process, incidentally, that Michael Voss was part of, and he ran well behind Craig McRae, who obviously got the job and has won a premiership, and Adam Kingsley, who's now the coach of the Giants. They were ahead of Voss. And don't forget that also Graham Wright approached Sam Mitchell, who he knew from Hawthorn, prior to that process. So Voss was well back in the order. So I don't think this is another, but that is probably the template as I've written, already, that should be up soon in The Age, that the Collingwood template would make a lot of sense. I think that's most likely where they'll go. You can't rule out that they would approach, someone like John Longmire, but I personally think that's less likely, bearing in mind that Carlton's playing list still has a lot of spade work to do. They need to bring in younger players. They're getting Cody Walker, a very talented young player, at the end of the year as a father-son. They're remaking their list. They've got a bit of a muscle team, Mary, with a lot of strong bodies, but not a lot of speed and volume.
We're talking about Michael Voss's exit. We're talking with Jake Nile, chief writer for The Age, but also Joel Bowden. We've got you back on the line. Just want to throw this out to you quickly to end on. What next for Michael Voss, or at least what is in his future? It's been a pretty brutal, bruising year this year. Is he coaching again, head coaching again, Joel?
Oh, I don't think he'll coach again as a senior coach, but he'll probably move into a mentor role. He'll do some media work, and I hope he takes some time off. I hope he gets away and relaxes, because he was and is Brisbane's greatest ever captain and a champion of the game. He hasn't been as successful in coaching, but he will no doubt stay in football because he's a football person. Clearly, he loves the game, and he still has a lot to offer in whatever capacity he chooses to. He hasn't quite been as successful as he would wanted at Carlton, and I'm sure all the Blues fans would like to see him more successful, but he'll no doubt stay in football, and, you know, he might end up like a special comments, and who knows, he could go down to Tasmania and help them.
Oh, there you go.
The Tasmanian Footy League going. I know my mate Brendan Gale would have anyone of Voss's quality down there to
help
mentor the players down there, start their academy, the Tassie Academy led by Michael Voss.
Jake, do you also see that in Michael Voss's future?
Yeah, I've got to jump off, Mary, but yeah, I think he'll go back to assistant coach.
Go back.
Most likely, but, you know, take the time off. It's a brutal game, and he's been sacked twice, gone from jobs early twice, and he's a really good person who stood up extremely well to the not inconsiderable pressures of coaching the Blues.
Jake and Joel, thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Jake Nile from The Age and Joel Bowden, former president of Players Association and Richmond player as well. Really quickly going to try to get to Talia in Melbourne. What do you think about broken promises, Talia?
Oh, hi. Yeah, just a couple of things to say. One is there's a bit of an irony in people mentioning politicians' integrity about promises and yet being really, really blunt about pure self-interest when it comes to the avoidance of taxes.
So you think broken promises doesn't matter as long as you agree with it?
I think that broken promises do matter. And actually the thing that I did call to say was that a lot of people have called in and said that they should say all things remaining the same at the beginning and, you know, conditions are as they should be, it continue. But the public aren't going to buy that.
Yeah, interesting, Talia. Thank you. And certainly I see a lot of both sides of that on text. Fascinating conversation today. And we, of course, will be looking at seeing what's happening in the budget. Will be covered by 774 tonight. Bridget Duclos is also in your afternoon.
Poor Vossie.
I know.
Poor Vossie.
Everyone loves him.
I loved him as a player. Gosh, exactly. I loved him. But interesting, on the day that he has stood down, there's some really fascinating research that people who leave games before the siren or sort of start not even going to games, it's a pretty good sign they will be the ones that stop their memberships with clubs. And it made me wonder, have you done that? Have you left your club and gone somewhere else? Are you allowed to change football teams?
You're asking someone who was born in New South Wales, followed rugby league first.
Had you ever changed teams?
Oh, you have two or three at a time. That's the thing. You don't. Yeah,
see, that's not allowed in Melbourne.
No, I found that out.
I got crucified for changing teams. I will explain a bit later. So we want to know that. Can you or have you changed your football team? Also, one of our young producers here at the ABC told us about a dating thing he's been doing, and I'd not heard of this. So we thought we'd discuss modern day dating. With the question in mind, Mary, probably when you and I met our partners, it was a different world.
Very different.
So dating's changed a lot. And I want to know, how did you meet your partner? Was it the old-fashioned way?
In a workplace?
At a square dance? In a workplace, in your case? Was it on a dating app? Was it with your banana in your trolley at the supermarket? These are all ways. So we're going to have a bit of fun with
real-life dating. Yep. I wonder if anyone does it anymore.
Well, they do. These young kids are going to come in and talk to us about it. But I really want to know from you, how did you meet your partner? And there's no wrong or right. Good luck to you if you've met one, I say.
I'm just glad it all happened before the ages of online and social media.
Well, that's
and things
our kids now, though.
I know. Bridget Duclos is on your afternoons. Thank you very much for joining me today. You can listen to the Conversation Hour on the ABC Listen app and write to me as well. We are always here to listen to what you want to talk about. Conversation Hour at abc.net.au is the email to write to. And of course, do keep across all of the ABC news platforms. There will be coverage of the budget from 7:30 on 774 tonight and across all of the ABC news platforms. Have a great day today. Take care, and I will speak to you tomorrow.